I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. When it comes to educating our children, few issues have been as deeply divisive as evolution. From courtrooms to pulpits to classrooms, these are the battlegrounds of evolution education. Today we'll talk with a KU history professor to examine the course of this controversial subject. We'll look at what made it a hot-button issue during the Scopes trial and why it has remained so for nearly 80 years. We'll discuss the various alternatives proposed to replace or be taught alongside Darwin's theory, plus a look at the forces supporting and opposing teaching evolution in our schools. From the Scopes trial of the 1920s to intelligent design, it's the anti-evolutionary controversies in American culture on Up to Date following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. It's the issue that never goes away, evolution and how to teach it. Critics and supporters of evolution have fought nonstop over the role of science and religion in American public life, and that battle continues in both Missouri and Kansas, where the issue always smolders. In Missouri this year, a Republican lawmaker from Harrisonville said he wants all students in Missouri public schools to be taught intelligent design alongside evolution in their science classes. Today, a conversation about why evolution has been controversial for the last 80 years since the Scopes trial. Our guest is University of Kansas history professor Jeff Moran. He's the author of American Genesis, The Evolution Controversies from Scopes to Creation Science. And just to prove he's willing to take on all comers, he's also author of Teaching Sex, The Shaping of Adolescence in the 20th Century. And Jeff, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, I gather you prefer issues that are too hot to touch, but you go ahead and touch them anyway. How come?
Well, when you teach 20th century American history, you can't get around that, really. But I thought with these two issues in particular, since you said they're perennial, so I will always be in business.
And they do have a great shaping effect on the 20th century?
I think so. Especially sex education is really partly responsible for the rise of the new right. And anti-evolution is simply a perennial.
Hmm. Well, so evolution and how to teach it and sex and how to teach it stay with us. And Jeff, they remain as intensely controversial as ever. Because why?
Well, Steve, I think they really speak to deeper issues in American culture, especially kind of, you know, our relationship with sexuality, our relationship with religion. And they also have to do with the schools. And the schools are really the one place where Americans can talk about what they want their children to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, husband and wives can talk about that too. But
so you think 50 years from now, 100 years from now, these two issues still might be front and center on the hotly, intensely controversial scale?
I think they're not going away. Yeah, I think they're not going away at all.
Yeah. You think people would tire of them after a while?
Well, I think they walk away from them for a little while and then they come back to them. After the Scopes trial, we went about 40 years before there was any more issues with evolution because anti-evolutionists kind of went underground. And in most of the public schools, they didn't teach evolution very much.
You get a sense, too, that in Kansas, after the controversies of recent years, people are tired of it, too.
I think that's right. Certainly everybody I know is a little tired of it. And I think a little embarrassed, too.
A little embarrassed, too.
Yeah.
You talk in your book about folks who said that this controversy could hurt, you know, job creation, attracting new businesses, mm-hmm. those kinds of economic development issues.
Absolutely. And this is something at the local level, you know, in cities and the broader level of the states. If you want to get high-tech companies, if you want biotech companies, you don't want to sound like your city is made up of hillbillies. It's just not going to be attractive.
Well, you write, Jeff, that when you came to Kansas back in 98, you thought that the anti-evolution movement was something from the deep, dark, distant past. But then came the next year, 1999. Remind us what happened that year.
1999, the state school board of Kansas decided that they were going to leave the teaching of evolution up to local control, with the plain implication that if you just leave it up to the local school boards, it's going to stop being taught altogether. So they took it off the state science standards and said, teach what you want.
And just to be clear, they didn't say you couldn't teach it. They just said it's up to the locals to figure out what they want to do.
That's right. But if you think about it, put yourself in the shoes of a biology teacher in Hayes or somewhere. Nothing against Hayes. You're reaching a point in the semester. You're thinking, I've got a lot of grading. I've got a lot of more teaching to do. Do I really want irate parents coming into my classroom and complaining to me that I'm tearing religion away from my child? Sometimes it's just easier to talk about pronghorn antelope, or sheep, I guess.
Than worry about stuff like that.
Exactly.
Well, how surprised were you that here you are, you've been on the East Coast, I think, for a while. You come back to the Midwest, you're born in Wisconsin, and suddenly this issue is front and center. What did you make of that?
I was baffled. I guess gobsmacked would be the word that people use. it was funny because a lot of the faculty at KU are from elsewhere. I mean, almost all of them are. And, I have colleagues from Spain, and they were getting emails from their friends back in Spain saying, what have you done? Why are you there? And I got the same thing from my friends back in Boston.
But so instead, you decided you wanted to explore this a little bit more. What was so intriguing to you about it?
Well, just the fact that I was teaching it as history, and suddenly I'm in the mainstream of what's going on in America. And you don't, as a history professor, you don't get that very often. If you're teaching about the Albigensian heresy, it's not going to come up anymore. But if you're teaching about the 20th century, these things keep coming back. And with the Scopes trial in particular, I thought it was gone, and lo and behold, it was still there.
I'm going to catch you cold on this, and maybe I'm not being fair, but how many school boards in Kansas actually took up the state board on its offer to and opted to teach evolution and intelligent design side by side? Do we have any numbers on that?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I have numbers on Kansas in particular, but sort of nationwide, you've got not that many. There are a lot of people. There's a real push for in American public opinion that you should just teach both at the same time. But 60% of Americans think you should teach creationism and evolution, because it seems like the fair way to go. As a practical matter, it's different. About 62% of public schools teach evolution only, because that's biology teachers are trained for that kind of thing.
What percent was that again?
About 60% teach evolution only and skip intelligent design.
So still the majority of schools are doing that.
Yes, that's right. Again, biology teachers, by and large, are trained actually to teach something about evolution. That's your college for you. And so they might soft pedal part of it, but it's still, they report about 60% of them. On the other hand, about 25% of them also teach creationism at the same time, and about 7% of them teach only creationism.
I pulled some numbers off the Gallup poll in preparation for the show, Jeff, and I found that just over a year ago, Gallup found that 4 in 10 Americans, slightly fewer than in years past, believe that God created humans in their present form about 10,000 years ago. 38%, about the same number, believe God guided a process by which humans developed over millions of years from less advanced life forms, while 16%, up slightly from previous years, believe humans developed over millions of years without God's involvement. So those are the kinds of numbers that are affecting what our teachers are doing in the classroom these days.
That's right. Well, given those numbers, about 80% of Americans believe in young earth creationism or some other sort of creationism, I guess we should be happy that so many schools actually teach evolution in the first place.
Are you surprised by the level of support these days for creationism, just not even in schools but among the adult population, folks who believe in creationism as opposed to evolution? Because I guess it just floors me.
It's more prevalent here. I was surprised when I moved here from Massachusetts, because the religious culture is quite different in the Midwest than it is from there.
Yeah.
I guess it doesn't surprise me at this point. I was surprised 10 years ago, 12 years ago.
You've gotten used to it.
I've gotten used to it. You become inured to anything.
Yeah.
But America is the most religious of all developed countries. We rank up there something like 80%, 90% of Americans claim that religion is very important to them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is far higher than other developed nations. You go throughout Western Europe, for example, 5%, 10% of Western Europeans will say, religion is one of the most important things in my life.
And so your point is that makes Americans, what, perhaps more susceptible to a deeper belief in creationism as over evolution?
Absolutely. I mean, a big part of this deep belief in religion is deep belief in the Bible itself. And, you know, in America, it's primarily a Protestant nation. And a fundamental element of Protestantism is you can read the Bible yourself. You get a plain reading of the Bible. And when you sit down to do that, you can suss out the literal truth of the Bible. And if you look at the Bible and you look at Genesis 1 through 11, it's pretty clear there. 6 days. It doesn't say 6 days of 24 hours. But, you know, if you're reading it very literally, 6 days. And we have 24 hours in our days. It used to be that fundamentalists believed that 6 days could be 6 days of thousands of years apiece, millions of years apiece. We don't have that anymore.
Hmm. Well, we talked about maybe Kansans being a little tired of the controversy about evolution in their state. But just this year on the Missouri side of the state line, we find out the issue is alive and well in the Missouri General Assembly. Jeff, what's happening over there?
I will say that is my favorite creationist bill of all of them. You know, they've got them in Ohio, in Indiana, and elsewhere. But House Bill 1227 in Missouri mandates equal time for intelligent design and evolution in public educational institutions. And the great thing is—
Equal time.
Equal time.
50% each, yeah.
50-50. But the great thing is it's not just for the grade schools, middle schools, high schools. This is supposed to apply to University of Missouri, supposed to apply to Southwest Missouri State. And, you know, as Kansans, we think this sort of justifies what we think about University of Missouri anyway.
The issue doesn't seem to have really sparked tons of controversy, but I've read about this bill. It's not supposed to have that great a chance of passage. But are we seeing professors at the University of Missouri come out and speak out against it, or what's happening with this bill?
We haven't seen a whole lot from faculty at University of Missouri. I think there's a general sense that this bill is going to be dead on arrival. And that's true for a lot of these bills. It's kind of a symbolic gesture by a couple of legislators. Mm-hmm. They can go back to their constituents and say, you know, I have fought for the faith of my fathers, but, you know, God forbid it actually gets through.
You write in your new book, and again, your new book, it's just coming out, is American Genesis, the Evolution Controversies from Scopes to Creation Science. You write that the struggles over evolution open a window onto American culture. Big question here, Jeff, but what do you think we see when we look out that window these days?
Well, we look at the Americanization of Charles Darwin. So you can look at things like democratization, which could be populism, could just be, you know, democracy. So you know, the populist approach to the Bible, the populist approach to science is, well, your opinion is about as good as mine. And I'm not just going to sit here and let this little oligarchy of self-styled intellectuals tell me what goes into the schools and what my children should believe. Yeah. And that's, I think, a powerful strain in American culture, for better or for worse.
Do you take a position in your book about all this? Do you come down on one side or the other?
Well, my job as a historian is to analyze rather than come down. But you know what? I sort of did the calculation. I graduated from 26th grade in the course of going through high school, college, and graduate school.
Wow.
So after 26th grade, you have a pretty good faith in the power of education. Mm-hmm. So you're in favor of more education and more accurate education than another. It doesn't – but my book is not a brief for one side or the other.
It tells the story of why this issue has remained an issue for so long.
Yeah, and you can tell the story without saying this is stupid or this is proper, this is what God intended. People can kind of draw their own conclusions. I suspect that here and there in the book, my sympathies are clear.
We're talking about teaching evolution in American schools this morning with Jeff Moran. He's a University of Kansas history professor. What do you make of the fact that the debate on teaching evolution in our schools continues almost unabated today? What should our schools be doing, and what do you make of the fact that more Americans these days describe themselves as believers in creationism rather than evolution? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, uptodate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Let's go to some phone calls who are already in the queue here. This issue gets them going. Dale from Kansas City, Missouri. Dale, good morning.
Good morning. I was just curious why the conversation's even coming up. because I was thinking that I thought our Constitution for required separation of church and state. And I say that as a lapsed Baptist. So I'm from a fundamentalist background, but if the churches want to teach it in their church, they should have every right. But they should not, in my opinion, given the U.S. Constitution, mandate that it be taught in the public school system.
Why isn't there a clear divide there and this teaching of evolution based on Dale's question? Why isn't it simply illegal?
Well, actually, you're right. It is illegal.
It is.
There's been a series of Supreme Court decisions starting in 1968 that say basically teaching creationism in the schools is a violation of the First Amendment, that it is an establishment of religion. And so there have been a series of attempts by anti-evolutionists to get around these decisions. But the Supreme Court has been pretty clear, decision after decision, that you can't do it.
So why does it happen then? How can it happen?
People still love it. And there are strategies around it. The most recent strategy is, of course, intelligent design. And what intelligent design does is it says it's not creationism. It's not about religion. It's simply saying there are things that we don't know, and so you should teach about the fact that we don't know anything about them and that Darwinism doesn't have an answer.
So that's the way they've gotten around the Supreme Court rulings then.
Exactly.
The folks who believe in creationism.
That's right. Well, there haven't been any Supreme Court decisions about intelligent design yet. But it's one of those things where they think if you don't specify who the creator is, you can get away with saying there might be a creator somewhere out there.
You know, you point out in your book, Jeff, that in the centuries before the Scopes trial, which was in 1925, few scientists and theologians saw any difficulty in accepting Genesis as a valid account of the creation of the universe. And this obviously after the scientific revolution in Europe. Why was that? Why were things different then than they are now?
Well, you didn't really have the dichotomy between science and religion for hundreds of years. The people who were scientists were usually church people as well, and the church at this point would have been the Catholic Church, supported these scientific endeavors. And there was a general sense that there are two books of understanding. There's the biblical revelation up above. There is the book of nature down below. And there was a sense that they support one another. You're not going to get some sort of conflict between science and religion because one sheds more light on the other.
But then at some point then that thinking changes though, right?
It really begins, there are problems here and there even earlier. You know, Copernicus got in trouble, Galileo got in trouble, but they were churchmen themselves. Probably the biggest issue was with Giordano Bruno, who ended up getting burned at the stake in 1600. I think he probably had some trouble with separation of religion and science. But by and large, these were the same people, and they didn't have much of a problem. It begins to change really in the 19th century, 18th, 19th century, where science begins to take a position that if you're going to prove something, you can't prove it by saying that God did it. You've got to have a naturalistic basis of proof. And at that point, if you start not paying so much attention to God as an explanation,
mm-hmm.
Then eventually you can sort of leave God out altogether.
What caused that kind of thinking to morph into the way that it became, Jeff? What was going on in society that brought us to that point?
Well, I think you can look mostly at the 18th and 19th centuries. Science was becoming, I guess you could say, better. It was becoming more secular, and it came to be considered by that time kind of an embarrassment if you had to look to religion for an explanation of natural processes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is, secularization itself proceeded pretty slowly. It didn't come out automatically, but in the sciences, at least secular explanations became important.
And there was at some point where there was a sense in society that there were the enlightened people and those not so enlightened, and there was a sort of an intellectual divide that sort of cropped up as well.
Well, if you want to put a date on it or a period on it, that's really late 19th century where people really started talking about this divide. And in America, as a practical matter, talking about the divide between science and religion was really an anti-Catholic discussion. That the problem was not necessarily religion itself, but the Pope. And then this gets broadened out to say, well, there is this division between science and religion. You've got one or the other, but basically the idea that the Pope has persecuted scientists from the 16th century onward.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, update@kcur.org. Jim from Olathe, who's a high school biology teacher. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I was a high school teacher.
Okay.
I haven't been for a number of years, but I was teaching biology in Chicago. And in 1980, the creationism movement hit Chicago. It hit the country, I guess, but we were certainly aware of it. And we were using textbooks from the 1970s that had no less than 13 chapters on evolution.
Wow.
And they report, you know, I mean, it was a wonderful education on the source of all species on Earth, and tremendously exciting knowledge. And then they came out with new textbooks, and they had one chapter on evolution after that. And we said, what went on here? Because a high school teacher is not equipped to just ad lib this. And they said, well, the Texas School Board is the biggest buyer of textbooks in the country, and they didn't want that in their textbooks anymore. And since they were the biggest buyers, the major book publishers like Houghton Mifflin and whatever stopped putting it in there. And we were just abhorred by this. You know, it was just, and I still have the old book, and it's one of my most treasured books because it isn't just a matter of the right to teach it. It's having all of the tools in your textbook to teach it. And this is the damage that's been done that I just, you know, I think is just has to be commented on.
Jim, how did you react to that in the classroom? How did you respond to this new requirement that you spend less time on evolution? Did you do that or did you rebel against it?
I saved all of our old textbooks and kept on using them.
Mm-hmm.
They were really wonderful textbooks. And I, like I said, I still have one of them, and it's one of my most valuable books because it you know, like I said, a high school teacher just isn't equipped to teach it without the resources of the textbooks.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Jim, thank you for the phone call. I appreciate it. And you point out in your book, Jeff, that there have been different periods in American history where there's enough churning going on where this issue tends to rise up again, the teaching of evolution, the 1920s, the 1960s, I think in the 80s and 90s, to get to our caller's point here, this issue seems to come up periodically. And what's happening in society when it does?
Well, Steve, one of the big things that creates these upsurges of anti-evolutionism is, I think, social disorder. There's an impulse in the 1920s and 1960s, even more so, when society is not going the way that a lot of traditional conservatives want it to. You look for explanations, and you know, you might look for things that are going away from the Bible. And in the public schools, this is pretty clear. If they're teaching evolution, this seems to contradict Genesis. And so the 1960s was a big moment when people who had become Christian conservatives really looked into these textbooks, as the caller said, you know, really good textbooks, and realized this was contrary to what they wanted their children to be learning.
So they pushed back and pushed back hard, right?
Absolutely. And by that time, they had had this the creation of this scientific creationism, where they thought that, you know, their science was as good as the science that they were reading in the textbooks.
Teaching evolution is our topic today. Let's go to Nathan from Leawood. Nathan, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Good morning. And my question is for both you, Steve, and for the guest. Reporters have pointed out that there seems to be a paraculture of fake news that's going on with the evolution debate. And these people want to put out things like abortion causes breast cancer, or there is no cause for anthropic global warming, or things like that. And because we live in a news culture that wants to give balance to both sides, these claims, which are not based in fact, keep getting put into the news cycle.
Hmm.
So I was wondering for both you and the guest, what is the response for a person who wants to be critical thinking about what is actually scientific fact?
Nathan, thank you. Good phone call. Jeff?
Well, Steve, I might throw that question back. Might throw that question back to you. What is it that you journalists are doing by trying to present both sides of an issue?
You know, that's a great question. That really gets the core of what my industry is about. We do try to write stories that present both sides. You go to a debate at a school board meeting where this issue is being debated. I guess it's the way we approach that is we have the reporter write a story that reflects what both arguments are.
Right.
And that's and our caller clearly is raising that into question, and a lot of other folks have too over the years.
Well, as the caller is, I think, hinting at, the trouble with that is, of course, you know, sometimes there are two sides to an issue, and they're equal.
Yes.
Sometimes there are two sides, and they're
one side is right,
unequal.
One side is wrong, perhaps.
Correct.
In some cases.
There's this American democratic idea that, of course, you know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But the difficulty in the news about this is what you get is, you know, five or six people at the Discovery Institute being represented as the equal of 480,000 life scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sounds like it's equivalent on the news, but as a practical matter, it's completely asymmetric.
Let's grab one more phone call here before a break. Mary Helen from North Kansas City. Good morning.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
A very small response to the fellow who had the great textbooks in Chicago.
Yeah.
A long time ago, I put on my Facebook how wonderful it is that we can now have electronic textbooks, and that will nullify the Texas tyranny over defective textbooks. Because when we have it on the computer, we don't have to just go by what the book says. You know, we can quit letting Texas be the Bible. But the reason I called was perhaps if we pass this idea that we have to teach creationism, having been a teacher myself and studied children's literature, I found out that there are many, many, many religions that have all kinds of different creationist theories. You know, how was it not just the Bible's version of why people are on the earth? And if we have to teach creationism, and if I had to teach creationism, I would teach every myth of every strange, weird religion everywhere. And it wouldn't take very many brains to discover how silly it is to take a 6,000-year-old Babylonian myth and put that in the Bible and make it be the set-in-stone word of God. That you have to believe or you're going to hell.
Jeff?
You know, so if you taught all these myths about African religions and all kinds of other religions and the Roman religions and all these other myths and compare them, which you would have to do if you were going to teach religion in your school, then it wouldn't take very long before people, people would have to, their brains would kick in and they would see this good sense of understanding and studying evolution. And, I mean, all of our science is based on that.
Mary Helen, thank you for the good call. Jeff?
Well, I guess the question is whether you would teach, you know, the Bantu creation myths in biology class or leave that to sociology or history of religion or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, there are great creation myths, but they're all from oral cultures by and large. And the great thing about oral cultures is you don't have the same standards of proof as you do. So,
well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Jeff Moran about teaching evolution in our classrooms. And again, I should remind folks that he'll be speaking tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Commons in Spooner Hall on the KU campus. That lecture, which is titled The Anti-Evolution Controversies and American Culture, is supported by the Friends of the Hall Center and co-sponsored by our friends at Kansas Public Radio. That's tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Commons at Spooner Hall. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about teen love, you can find it in all of our programs online at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, the book doctors are back with their latest reading picks. That's tomorrow. Today we're talking about teaching evolution in the classroom. We're visiting with KU history professor Jeff Moran. He's author of a new book, American Genesis, The Evolution Controversies from Scopes to Creation Science. And again, he speaks tomorrow evening at 7:30 on the KU campus at the Commons at Spooner Hall. Jeff, let's just talk for a moment before we go back to some phone calls here about what happened at the Scopes trial in Tennessee back in 1925. What was the issue? Why did this thing become the national issue that it eventually became as a result of that trial?
Well, we like to think it became national because of the issues that were being raised. It really became a national controversy, I think, because the two major figures in this, William Jennings Bryan, was for the prosecution of the teacher, John Scopes. And Bryan had run for president three times. He was the great commoner, mm-hmm. the voice of the people. And Clarence Darrow was a notorious agnostic mm-hmm. and, of course, the best-known criminal trial lawyer in the country. And so when the two of them got together, that's news.
Mm-hmm. And it became this huge cause and so much attention. Tell us about how many reporters were there and why this thing grew the way it did.
Oh, well, it was originally just this little case. The ACLU advertised for a test case, and these boosters in Dayton sort of wanted to get a little bit of attention for the town. And they agreed to run this test case in Dayton, and it just blew up in their –
That's where Scopes was a teacher. That's where he worked, right?
Right. He was a high school teacher and football coach for a little while he was there.
He basically said, I want to be the test case. I want to be brought to trial to have this issue aired out, right?
That's right. I mean, he felt from his training, and his father was actually kind of a labor radical too, so he didn't mind rocking the boat. He said, yeah, I'm happy to stand up for this. Scopes himself didn't get to speak for the entire trial until the last day when he said, I think the fine is unjust, but the prosecution actually paid for his fine.
He was found guilty.
He had to be found guilty. Clarence Darrow, at the end of the trial, basically had to say, you know, he told the jury, we haven't gotten a chance to present our case anyway. I don't really care what you think about his guilt or his innocence, but I'd like you to find him guilty. Because if you want to keep appealing a case, you've got to be on the losing side. And Darrow thought mm-hmm. this was going to go up all the way to the Supreme Court. So he had to keep losing.
And did it?
It didn't. It went up to the Tennessee Supreme Court. And the Tennessee Supreme Court was clever. They basically overturned the conviction and then made sure that the prosecutor agreed that he would never bring another case like this to his attention, to their attention. And so what that meant is Darrow didn't have any case to appeal, and nobody was going to bring up another case in Tennessee, and there wasn't another case in Tennessee until after 1968.
What was the impact of this case on other school districts across the country?
Well, it affected a few other states. A number of states right after the Scopes trial actually passed their own anti-evolution bills, and even more tried to. But it didn't really get anywhere out of the South. In Rhode Island, for example, somebody proposed an anti-evolution bill, and it was referred to the Committee on Game and Fish, you know, sort of mocking that in mm-hmm. a different area. I think the effect was really on the local level, that there were districts after districts where they just decided this is too hot of a topic. We're not going to teach evolution. And so by the time you get to 1960, there's less evolution being taught than there was in 1925.
Wow. Back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Mark from Kansas City, Missouri. Mark, good morning. You're on with Jeff Moran.
Good morning. My question is, how does teaching intelligent design square with another American value, and that's religious diversity?
Well, there is a sense of religious diversity in the fact that people should get to believe in whatever they want. But the Supreme Court has found that evolution, for example, is not a religion, although some creationists have tried to say it is. And therefore, a teacher doesn't have sort of free speech and freedom of belief when he or she is trying to teach it in the classroom. So
I was thinking more of students in terms of the religious diversity of our country, not so much classroom teachers.
Right. Well, my friends who teach in the biology department and geology department at the University of Kansas say, quite frankly, you know, they tell their students, you're welcome to believe anything you want, but if you want a good grade in this class, you have to understand evolution.
Hope that helps, Mark.
Yep, thanks.
Thank you. Ralph from Prairie Village. Ralph, you're on Up to Date.
Hello. I got two questions. My first question is, now, why exactly do we even care so much nationally about evolution versus creationism in schools when every school is funded and decided upon its curriculum based upon community involvement and districting within the state, not within the nation? So why should we let something that came from Tennessee influence Kansas and Missouri?
Well, a lot of these different cases in different states inspire other states. I mean, I think it is a national issue. And I think when one state inspires another, you know, I think Kansas inspired people in Pennsylvania to bring a different case. Ohio has inspired Indiana. It becomes a national issue. And maybe in Kansas and Missouri, we should only worry about ourselves. But it's pretty useful to know what's going on elsewhere.
Okay, Ralph, thank you. Let's go to Dan from Independence. Dan, good morning.
Hi, good morning, you guys. Of course, the two sides or the multiple sides of this question have all kinds, raise all kinds of excitement and lots of opinions. I think a lot of the questions should be covered in philosophy. I have a couple of default positions that I take when I hear the argument come up. And one is that when Darwin came up with the theory, there was another guy, Wallace, who published a little bit later, who didn't get as much credit for this. Everybody seems to turn to Darwin and say, oh, this guy, you know, this beast has come up with this thing that's whatever. But anyway, before their time, the world had made it up to that point without knowing anything about evolution, and evidently has gone ahead since then. So from an individual standpoint, whether you choose to believe in evolution or not may not really in a substantial way affect how successful you are in life. Of course, you don't even have to believe in history. That analysis, you know, you might want to throw that out too. I've kind of come down to the idea that maybe a book on evolution should have a disclaimer on it, much like a pack of cigarettes, that just says, you know, you don't have to believe this, but you can use it.
Hmm.
And the hierarchy, I have a scientific, I have an engineering background, but some in biology and geology too. And it seems like that when Linnaeus started to assign all the different categories for the species to fall into, that as soon as evolution happened, a bunch of these logical people said, why don't we try to hang these in the framework of evolution? And I can see if you're going to go into a business that's very closely associated with that,
right,
you need to believe it as if it is the truth. But in a personal sense, you really don't have to believe it to be successful in life.
Dan, thank you. Should your book have a disclaimer on it?
I don't think so. You know, it's not a book about evolution. Mm-hmm. People are welcome to try to do that. I think my publisher would have something else to say about that. But as far as whether you need to know evolution for success in the rest of your life, I would hate to have a doctor who didn't believe in evolution, mm-hmm. for example. You know, maybe a dentist could get away with it, but to have a doctor who didn't actually understand why you have the structures that you do, I think that would be very worrisome. And just in general, this country needs a certain amount of scientific literacy. Now, here I am speaking as an advocate again, but, you know.
Dan, thank you for your phone call. A couple interesting messages on KCUR's Facebook page. Scott writes us this: as a science teacher in training at UMKC and a former Christian minister turned atheist, I am angry and frustrated that this issue continues to raise its ugly head. Victor writes us this via email at updatedatkcur.org. Can your guests explain why creationism should not be taught as a theory along with evolution as a theory? Parents have a right to have a voice as to what is taught.
Well, part of this goes to the question of what a theory is.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of a scientific theory is quite different from what we think of as, you know, I have a theory about why it is that cars always turn left rather than right or something like that. A scientific theory means that it's the best possible explanation that we have given the information that we have now. And so creationists will attack evolution as merely a theory, but you could attack gravity as merely a theory. Breathing, I suppose, is merely a theory. So there is a higher level of proof when you have a scientific theory than if you just have a theory that you've pulled out of somewhere.
Mick on Facebook writes this: a large portion of the scientific community consider it a proven fact that evolution by natural or artificial selection is more than just a mere theory. Creationism, intelligent design, etc., suffers from a lack of evidence. As such, those belong, if anywhere, in studies of philosophy and religion, but not in the science classroom, he writes. Let's go to Chris from Stillwell. Chris, you're on the program. Good morning. Our topic today, Chris, I guess, isn't there teaching creationism in the classroom. Let's go to Ralph from Prairie Village. Ralph, good morning. Dan from Independence. Dan, nice to have you. Good morning. Okay, lots of folks not there. Let's move on. In the preceding the Scopes trial, Jeff, there was a man named William Paley. Who was he, and what did he have to say about all this?
You could consider William Paley in some ways to be the grandfather of intelligent design today, although he had a very different reputation at the time. He was just a sort of country parson, or he was a very smart Cambridge University graduate. But in the early 19th century, he published a book called Natural Theology, which is basically laid out the design argument. If you're walking through a field and you come across a watch and it seems to work, the inference you would make is that somebody had designed this watch, that watches don't suddenly appear all on their own. And he said, you know, how much more magnificent is it if we look at the way nature operates to think that there is a designer up there and that he is looking out for us in the minutest parts of our lives.
Mm-hmm. And that's so he was sort of the founder then of that idea, that strain of thought.
Well, in some ways, you can go back all the way to Cicero, who actually made the same argument. Cicero talked about a sundial, mm-hmm. of course, and if you're in the early 19th century, you have timepieces, so it makes a stronger argument.
You know, in some ways, we're talking about threats to religion here as being at the heart of the issue, and you write about this in the book. A pair of threats you talk about. One was a threat that evolution posed to the book of Genesis's account of creation, and the threat was what, Jeff?
Well, the threat was against the literal account of Genesis, that
right.
If you don't believe the literal account of Genesis, what does that mean for the validity of the rest of the Bible? And, you know, if you have common descent, if you have the theory of common descent, that means that God didn't make all animals, all creatures, each after its kind, that they don't reproduce each after its kind, that, in fact, they descend with modification, as Darwin said. If you say that the earth is created in 6 days of 24 hours apiece, that creates a little problem with the geological record, which holds that the earth was created about 4.5 billion years ago.
Hmm. The other threat you write about centers around questions about the validity of the book of Genesis itself. And the idea was that if Genesis isn't true, then the entire Christian faith is something somewhat on the line here, right?
Well, right. I mean, you have to be able to believe in miracles to begin with, and Genesis is the biggest miracle. But the real support for creationism comes from people who are much more interested in the resurrection of Jesus and the salvation of souls. If you get rid of Genesis, that means you get rid of Adam and Eve. Mm-hmm. And if Adam didn't fall, if Eve didn't give him that apple, then there's no point in having Jesus come back again because there's no problem. Man didn't fall. There's no such thing as eternal sin.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here on Up to Date. Our email address, update@kcur.org. Again, Jeff Moran speaks tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Commons at Spooner Hall on the KU campus. We're talking today about teaching evolution in the classroom. A book titled The Genesis Flood came along in 1961, Jeff, and fired up the debate again during that tumultuous decade. What happened with that book, and what was that about?
Well, what you have to understand is for about 40 years after the Scopes trial, anti-evolutionism, creationism, kind of went underground. Yeah. It wasn't a national issue. It sort of hunkered down in the South, different institutions in the South. In the 1950s, there came to be this real argument within a lot of evangelical Christian circles that how old is the earth actually? When William Jennings Bryan in 1925 believed that each of the days of Genesis could be thousands or could be millions of years old. In the 1950s, you get the rise of what we call young earth creationists who tried to argue scientifically that the earth was in fact created 6,000 years ago in 6 days of 24 hours apiece. Hmm. And they had scientific proof, and part of this proof came through the Genesis flood, the idea that the flood in Genesis, Noah's flood, had so rearranged the geological record that kind of hapless geologists, hapless biologists would look back and say, well, this looks like it's a million years old, but in fact, Morris and Whitcomb would argue, that's just the effect of the flood. It screwed everything up, and scientists aren't bright enough to figure that out.
Let's go to Reggie from Leawood. Reggie, you're on the program. Good morning.
Hi, interesting subject. I just want to get right to the point. The thought I was explaining is that it seems as though religion has failed miserably to be able to actually come up with a viable explanation as far as creation. And it has caused them to really pretty much come to the table without ammunition to back their claim that creation is true. However, with more information that has come out, especially with history and everything, creation does have a foot to stand on. But like I said, religion has pretty much, especially mainstream religion in the United States, has pretty much made it to where they don't have a leg to stand on. And they do it with so many other dogmatic teachings to where it does make the Bible seem like something that you can't trust. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Reggie, thank you.
This is one of the great advantages of the intelligent design argument. The founder, Phil Johnson, said, don't bring up the issue of the age of the earth or the Old Testament, because you'll get all these questions that skeptics have used against Christians forever. You know, did Joshua make the sun stand still? Did a big fish swallow anything? But intelligent design gets beyond that by essentially making a negative argument. There might be problems with evolution. Students could consider this. Now, people who follow intelligent design, the supporters, are pretty convinced for themselves that God, who looks a lot like the Old Testament God, is behind all of this. But they try to get away from this by, you know, in this higher standard of proof, by simply saying there are questions about it. Students should try to learn about these questions.
Well, speaking of students, you talk in the book about a pair of married students at KU who teach evolution, and they regularly witness students who have strong religious faith. They come in from these small towns around Kansas to Lawrence, having their faith tested when they learn about evolution, maybe for the first time. How do these professors, over the years, how have they come to approach that moment in their classrooms when it comes to actually seeing those students, that you can see it, the look in their faces sometimes as to what they're thinking?
My friends are pretty sympathetic, at least one of them is pretty sympathetic to what these students are going through. Both of them don't think, you know, they've got teachers of classes of 500 students. They're not going to become religious counselors to all of those students. But they both tell the students, you've got to understand this. And if you want to sort it out on your own, you go right ahead and sort it out on your own. And
that's what they recommend. You sort it out on your own. We're not going to tell you how to sort it out. They used to maybe try to sort it out for them, but they don't anymore.
That's right. And ideally, you'll have it sorted out to some extent in time for the final exam.
You point out that it's young people who did not go to college who see their attendance in church diminish over the years. Why is that?
Well, it's one of these strange things. You know, there's this popular idea that college can strip young people of their Christian faith. In fact, young people going to college stop going to church for a little while. Probably they're busy doing other things, being college students. Afterwards, kind of middle-class kids who graduate from college, they have families, they settle down, and they start going back to church. It's just sort of what you do in suburban America. People who haven't gone to college at all, high school graduates, have much higher rates of belief in creationism, or at least they're much, much less likely to believe in evolution. They've never had a biology course. What they know about creation is perhaps what they've heard at church, but they don't go to church all that often either.
What groups out there, Jeff, are working actively against teaching evolution in our schools today? Because you talk about some of these groups, and they're very well funded, and they're working very hard on this issue.
Well, the biggie is Answers in Genesis, which is kind of a combination American-Australian group. They've got millions of dollars in funding. They're actually much better funded than any of the sort of pro-evolution groups, or the one pro-evolution group. Because they're collecting money from all sorts of different churches and things. They're really the big name, and they're the group that's behind, people have heard in the news, behind the Creation Museum, which was just recently opened up in Kentucky, which is just like a natural history museum, except it's got Adam and Eve living alongside dinosaurs and, you know, it's sort of a strange inversion.
Have you been there?
I haven't been there yet. I've seen pictures. I think that's – my children might have something else to say about it, but that's vacation next summer.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, I sure enjoyed having you here. Thanks for taking some time.
Thanks for having me.
That's KU history professor Jeff Moran. He's author of American Genesis, The Evolution Controversies from Scopes to Creation Science. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow, the Book Doctors are back with their latest pick. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Kim Noble, Kathleen Pointer, Denny Alexander, and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.